before the war, had drawn cartoons for the Chicago Daily News and in Cleveland for the Newspaper Enterprise Association. When Herbert Block and my father met for the first time at the Yale Club in New York, Dad asked to see some of what Herb had done before the war, since in the Army he hadn't been doing political cartoons. In return, he sent Herb a subscription to the Post so that he could see How You Like Us, which Herb found interesting and inviting. Herb was hired and arrived simultaneously with Phil. As Herb Block, this amazing man has been drawing cartoons for the Post for over 50 years. His creative genius remains as strong as ever after all these years of solid performance, even at the age of 87. In 1946, Herbert Elliston was still the editorial page editor. My father's old associate, Charles Boyson, was business manager. There was an experienced advertising manager in Donald Bernard. Wayne Coy, Phil's friend and wartime associate, was assistant to the publisher. There was no one reliable in either production or circulation, or in labor relations. Phil had his work cut out for him. Under him, as managing editor, was Casey Jones, who had helped my father so much from the time he came to the Post in 1935. But after working with Jones for only a short time, Phil decided the paper needed a more sophisticated approach. Casey Jones had done a great deal, but he was an old-fashioned front-page type of character, and Phil was more ambitious than that. He began looking for a managing editor with whom he might be more comfortable. He heard about a man who had been working as editorial writer, managing editor, and Washington correspondent for the St. Paul Dispatch, St. Paul Pioneer Press. So he and I went out together to Minnesota to meet him. Phil was drawn to Russ Wiggins, a dynamo who had completed only high school but was extraordinarily well-read, and he offered Russ the job of Sunday editor, I suppose hoping to bring him up through the ranks gradually. After much anguish, Russ, being in the enviable position of having two good offers, turned Phil down, understandably choosing to become assistant to Arthur Sulzberger, then the publisher of the New York Times. Phil was also focusing on the news side of the paper, believing that much of the post-war world would be shaped by decisions that were then being made at the peace conference in Europe. He himself left for Europe in August with Herbert Elliston, while I stayed at the farm in Mount Kisco with the children. This was Phil's first journalistic tour and his first trip to Europe. One of the great perks of journalistic life, whether one is reporter, editor, or publisher, is a trip of this sort. If you love learning as much as Phil did and I do, these trips bring endless satisfactions. At the same time, you can occasionally do some good for the publication you represent, and for the governments involved, by reporting what you see and learn. This was just such a trip for Phil, one that made a deep impression on him. Isaiah Berlin always claimed, with some justice, I believe, that it contributed mightily to Phil's evolution away from the extreme liberalism of his law school days and the first few years after graduation. When we got back to Washington in the fall, Phil was not only running the paper and working to improve it, but also lending moral support to my father, who was finding the presidency of the World Bank even more burdensome than he had imagined. Phil worked hard to bolster his morale, helping him in every way he could, from advice to writing speeches. Trouble at the bank had arisen for my father almost immediately. The 12 directors had been named earlier and had been working together before his appointment. Many resented someone's coming in really to impose order and would rather have had a figurehead, and the job was difficult enough without the political infighting. Dad knew that if he stayed and fought, he could probably win, but he felt too old and too weary to try. Toward the end of October, he began thinking of the long-term future of the bank, 5, 10, or 15 years ahead. He realized that he wouldn't be there to carry out his own plans, and that the person who made them should be. "I made up my mind," he said, "that what the president and Jimmy Burns had asked me to do, I had more or less done, launched the bank by organizing it." On December 4, 1946, he tendered his resignation with only 2 weeks' notice, not even having the energy to stay until a successor was found. Ironically, his resignation succeeded in bringing about some of the reforms needed so that his eventual successor, John McCloy, could function effectively. By the time Dad returned to the Post in January 1947, a transition had occurred. The 6 months of his absence had given Phil the chance to establish his own authority, and he was clearly in charge. By the end of his first year, he was omnipresent and involved in everything. My father took the title of chairman of a non-existent board and had the generosity and wisdom to leave Phil as publisher and not try to take back the responsibilities he had ceded to him 6 months earlier. What he essentially did was to back Phil in all that he was doing. So there began a complicated but overall happy working relationship between my father and my husband, and another between Phil and me and my parents. The bank interlude simply brought about the transition overnight instead of gradually. Phil's respect for my father's experience and knowledge, and his genuine belief in Dad's sound judgment, meant that he gladly included him in major decisions and events in connection with the paper. In turn, my father's recognition of Phil's abilities and talents, particularly his facility with people, reinforced his inclination to support Phil's efforts and to back the paper financially. My mother, meanwhile, also required some of Phil's attention. She had gone on traveling, reporting, speaking, and writing on various issues after the war. One series of 24 articles on post-war problems resulted from 4 months of travel throughout the United States and was published in the Post during April and May of 1946. Phil thought the whole series was first rate. At the same time, Mother was intensifying her efforts on the social and welfare front, testifying before Congress on her conviction that the government's administrative machinery to deal with health and education had to become more efficient on every level, and stepping up her efforts in behalf of a bill sponsored originally by Senators Taft and Fulbright for the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Health, Education, and Security. Presaging a much later concern, she charged the radio and film industries with using their resources for a progressive vulgarization of the public mind and for the debasing of public morals. Somehow she also found time to be president of the Social Legislation Information Service and a member of the President's Commission on Higher Education, the Federal Hospital Council, and the District of Columbia Planning Committee. In 1947, she helped found the National Citizens Commission for Support of the Public Schools, in which she remained active until her death. At 60, she was still choosing to be, as Newsweek called her, not just a roving reporter, but also a one-woman reform movement. Her pieces for the Post were almost always long, frequently too long for a daily newspaper. She thought highly of her own writing, rightly so, and may have created, if not demanded, a hands-off approach on the part of editors. Casey Jones always claimed to have wielded his blue pencil fearlessly when it came to her pieces, but other editors quaked at the idea of editing her copy. Several true stories about her reactions to attempts to edit her work, as well as her conflicts with the Post over substance, took on the weight of legend. Once, when she sold an article to Collier's magazine, she was alleged to have flaunted her check in front of Jones, boasting, "See? Some people will actually pay me for writing for them." Casey gave her high praise by being quoted as saying, "That gal is a good reporter. She's no trained SEAL." The first conflict she had with the management of the Post, in which Phil became embroiled, took place in 1948 and involved an incident in which Herbert Elliston felt she had interfered with his work. He protested to Phil, noting that it was the only occasion he'd had to complain in the 8 years he'd been at the paper, that she had corrected a proof of an editorial of his on secularism and sent it directly to the composing room. Herbert felt, justly, that she had overstepped her bounds and that she had undermined his responsibility for the editorial page as well as his authority with the editorial staff, not to mention his reputation in the eyes of the men in the composing room. My mother was apologetic, but wounded. She wrote to Herbert at once, saying that she was horrified by the impression my unfortunate stupidity made upon you. She had her own version of what had happened, explaining it away as open to misinterpretation, but adding, "Dear Herbert, what hurts me more than my own stupidity is that you didn't trust me enough to take me aside when we met at dinner and say to me frankly and firmly, 'Look here, that's not the way to do things.' Then I could have explained to you at once that I meant no offense and apologized on the spot. Please tell Phil how it all happened, and please don't bother to answer this." Her true feelings came out the next day when she wrote Phil, ostensibly about a speech she was giving on the modern curriculum and released time, but throwing in these words, "I shall never again have any dealings whatsoever with any Post employee on any matter whatsoever. If I do any more about this, the wires are sure to get crossed, and it will be my fault. I refuse ever again to be exposed to the humiliation of lectures either from the staff or from you." Naturally, Phil had to take the time to assuage her hurt and smooth relations for the future good of the paper and all concerned. Phil's diplomatic skills and tact in dealing with this and so many other situations with my mother saved us all. He often ran interference on conflicts I had with her and took the lead in working out the personal relationship he and I developed with her and my father as my parents, as well as with them as the owners of the Post and my father as his boss initially. During this period, Phil continued to want me with him most of the time, but it was he who determined where we went. He hated most formal evenings, especially embassy dinners. Sometimes I begged to go somewhere that sounded glamorous, but he made the decision, and I complied. What I hadn't learned was to be more independent of Phil himself. Paradoxically, my mother should have been a role model, since she didn't operate under any constraints, but she had made her own daughters feel inferior to her, preventing us in some ways from viewing her as a positive example. Yet even she, with all her independence and ego, articulated the importance of being, and to some extent lived the life of, a wife whose primary obligation was to her husband and children. After Don's birth and Phil's return from overseas, I had not gone back to work. When Phil went to the Post, I made a unilateral decision not to, because I thought it would be too confusing for both of us to be there at once. Phil was less sure that this was right, and even encouraged me to come back. Early in 1947, his concern for what my life was becoming led him to suggest that I start writing a weekly column that would be a review and digest of what was interesting in the magazines. Its goal, as I described it in a letter to his sister, was to make me a little less stupid and domestic than I have been of late. My guess is that he thought up the idea to keep me working for the paper, but independent of its organization. Actually, ever since Phil had started on the Post, I had been thinking about taking a part-time job, but feared they didn't exist. This was a great one, about which I felt semi-apologetic, because I thought maybe it was make-work. In fact, Phil had picked up the idea from another paper, and the column still runs in the Post. It was called The Magazine Rack, and I began writing it for the Sunday paper in April 1947, paid the magnificent sum of $15 per column. It took me only a day to do, but invariably the writing fell on a difficult day, and I was often in a panic about finishing it. To my private surprise, however, I enjoyed the work, and I kept it up for several years, even picking up a subscriber along the way, the Louisville Courier-Journal, courtesy of our friend and its editor, Barry Bingham. About a year after the column first appeared, Barry wrote to Phil saying that his paper wanted to add a small amount of feature material. He had been watching the magazine column and thought it was just the kind of thing he would like to have once a week. Phil wrote Barry that his inquiry had made my day and that the Post would be delighted for the Courier to have the column right after a few weeks' maternity leave for the birth of our third child. He added, "I will let you decide what this expensive addition to the Courier-Journal will cost you. Mr. Meyer saw your letter and prevented my being more specific by saying, 'It is impossible for a publisher to put a price on his own wife. The best level is one a bit below the nominal and just a bit above peonage.'" Around the same time as I started the column, I increased my involvement in civic affairs. In 1947, I was appointed to the National Capital Sesquicentennial Commission, of which President Truman was the honorary chairman. It was during these immediate post-war years that I also got involved in welfare work, doing my share of fund drives, especially for the Community Chest and the National Symphony. I then went on the board of the Children's Convalescent Home. I hadn't known much about boards or volunteer work until I was approached to join this one, and I was upset when it turned out to be an old-fashioned social board. The very first meeting, held at the exclusive Sulgrave Club, was entirely occupied with where to put a plaque honoring a lady who had given funds for a bathroom. The board had been taken over by the second generation of the quite correct Washington families, who later did convert this home into a really useful institution, at which time I participated more happily. I was also preoccupied with dealing with our small children. In those days, and in our situation, there was no sharing of duties between parents. I did absolutely everything domestic, found the schools and supervised the children's activities, kept the social calendar for all of us, once Phil had decided what he and I would attend, and decorated the houses. I also was the one who had to see to repairs and renovations. In 1947, when Lally was 4, I got her into a nursery school which I described as very, very modern, whose application process presaged something of what today's parents go through. I was asked all sorts of odd questions, such as, did I think my home training had been successful? I roared with laughter and said I didn't know, but I supposed not. They also asked me what I wanted her to get out of nursery school, which I couldn't answer successfully either. I was never sure why they admitted her, certainly not on the basis of my responses, but decided it had to be the result of the test they gave her, in which she successfully put blocks together. What to do in the summers was something I struggled with during these years. Usually I took the children to Mount Kisco to visit my parents, but my feelings were invariably mixed about going to Seven Springs Farm. I knew the children would love it, as indeed they always did, and as I had as a child, but I didn't like the idea of leaving Phil in Washington to commute there for weekends, and since he worked all week with my father, I thought he might need a break from my family on weekends. I was also concerned about my mother's relations with my children and how she viewed their upbringing. She acted as though they had never eaten so well in their lives as when they were at her house. And there was also an unending comparison between our children and my brother's children, who were often there too in those years. This set up a tense competition between the families. But worst of all, my mother developed favorites among the grandchildren at different times in their lives, a favoritism she displayed with an astounding lack of sensitivity. Once, she came into the dining room, where the children were having an early dinner, and said, "Lally, I brought you a flower." I will never forget Donald, 2 years younger, saying quietly to no one in particular, "I guess Grandma couldn't find a flower for me." Although the children were the center of my life at this time, the main focus of Phil's attention, and at the center of our life together, was the post, where he was working on all fronts at once. His early memoranda to his executives are stunning in their detailed outline of problems, potential, and objectives in business and editorial areas. He looked at and analyzed everything, from making better use of editorial space to obtaining more newsprint, doing a more thorough job of research in order to improve the editorial content, preventing a street sales drop in summers, decreasing payroll costs, keeping expenses down, minimizing typos, misprints, and mechanical department problems, promoting the paper, and beefing up suburban coverage for Maryland and Virginia, part of a constant drive by all publishers of the Post to maintain a deep penetration of our local market. After only a year on the paper, Phil was thoroughly knowledgeable and totally in charge. As his secretary, Charlie Paradise, wrote a friend, "Since Phil joined the organization, he is doing his best to make things hectic around here, which meets with my thorough approbation." Phil became one of the Post's best ad salesmen, often writing letters to company executives around the country, giving forceful evidence for why the Post was a logical, cost-effective choice for their advertising dollars. He was so totally immersed in the paper and was spread so thin, having only a very fragile, if developing, organization under him, that he was undertaking his own labor negotiations, a poor idea, even for someone more experienced. He faced labor problems from the start, especially with the printers. After a particularly grueling period, he wrote Isaiah Berlin in January 1948 that he had just made an unsuccessful attempt to throttle the poor printers with the Taft-Hartley law. He also engaged in serious negotiations with the Post's circulation people, an area where costs had, as Phil put it, simply been killing us. He pushed for using the paper for educational purposes in schools throughout the area. He restored the comics to their pre-war size. He even undertook some extensive redecorating of the newsroom, which he described, to a vacationing Casey Jones, as not unlike childbirth, in that you get great results, but only at the cost of significant pain. Phil focused a lot of his attention on the people who worked for the paper and those he wanted to work for it. He knew everyone in the building, always taking on the problems of people who worked for him, worrying over someone's sick child, unmet mortgage payment, health crisis. He began actively recruiting young people with potential, as well as more established reporters and editors with proven abilities. And he was very interested in ensuring that women were working on the paper as well as reading it. One of the biggest changes for the paper took place in early April 1947, when Russ Wiggins came as managing editor. Phil and my father had gone back to Russ a year after their first offer, and this time he accepted, preferring to return to the writing and editing end of newspapers. Just before he agreed to come, my father asked him if he wanted to see a financial statement for the company, to which Russ replied, quite typically, "No, Mr. Meyer, you are enough of a financial statement for me." In what, no doubt, was a move upstairs, Casey Jones was given the title of assistant to the publisher and stayed on for another 3 years before leaving to become executive editor of the Syracuse Herald Journal. Russ's relationship with the Post was a happy and constructive one for the next 21 years. He immediately instituted several changes, which had a significant effect on the quality and integrity of the City Room. He announced a new set of rules, one of which ended the practice of routine racial identification in the paper. No longer would the Post write such lines as one identified by Charles Roberts in his history of the paper, "Sam Jones, 24, Negro, was arrested for larceny yesterday." Overnight, he eliminated freebies, trips paid for by the government, and free tickets for anything. Also, after just a few weeks on the job, he called in the police reporter, Al Lewis, to ask if he was having parking and other tickets fixed for people in the building. Al's prompt response was, "Yes, sir." Russ then asked, "For whom?" To which, much to Russ's consternation, Al replied, "For everybody." "What do you mean, everybody?" demanded Russ disbelievingly. "Well, people in the composing room, the advertising room, the newsroom, circulation. I just take them to the station and give them to the chief." Russ put an instant stop to this practice by saying, "Starting today, this minute, there is to be no more ticket fixing at police headquarters. We might have to be in a position to write some critical stories about the police department, and I don't want you or the Post to be beholden to the chief of police or anybody else." This new policy proved important right away, because one of the first editorial ventures undertaken by Russ and Phil was a crusade against crime, local and national. The local story led to a bitter fight with the Washington police, and in particular with Police Chief Robert J. Barrett, a veritable guerrilla war that began the year Russ arrived and went on for at least 4 more, until finally, in 1951, the Post supplied to a congressional committee convincing evidence of corruption, and Barrett retired amid charges that remained unresolved because he had invoked the Fifth Amendment. In those same years, cosmic events were developing abroad, starting with the Truman Doctrine in the spring of 1947 and followed by the Marshall Plan. The Post had just acquired Ferdinand Kuhn to report on foreign affairs, but had no one abroad, so it used wire services and occasionally freelancers. Prior to Russ's coming on board, Phil even let reporters take trips paid for by the military, all in an effort to beef up reporting of foreign news. Among the campaigns the Post took on was support for the Marshall Plan, which the paper featured regularly on the front page, and to which it devoted a special section in November 1947. This supplement, spearheaded by Phil and written by top Post reporters, won the National Headliners Club Award for Outstanding Public Service and was reprinted widely throughout the country. In fact, the paper was more and more being recognized. The Newspaper Guild, in the course of giving its Haywood Bruin Awards in early 1948, said of the Post, "In these days, when playing it safe and treading softly is so general, the record of the Washington Post in 1947 is truly extraordinary. It is a vivid demonstration of what an outstanding newspaper is like and what it can do in serving its readers, its community, and the country." On the downside, negotiations with the printers dragged on for months. Plans were made in case of a strike. "Very complicated business, a newspaper," Phil noted in a letter to my father late in 1947. It was a hard winter, one in which, as Phil said, every damn possible thing seemed to go wrong. Finally, by spring, the effects of Russ's coming to the paper, along with some other new top people, were beginning to be seen. And when the seemingly endless newspaper guild negotiations finally wound up, Phil and I took time out for a much-delayed vacation. We set off for Nassau at the end of March, by which time I was 8 months pregnant with our third child. Knowing the pace of life that we would soon return to, I clung to the sun and the sand with renewed intensity, feeling fine and fat and sunburned. While we were in Nassau, Phil had a call from CBS President Frank Stanton, who supervised the radio stations then owned and run by CBS. For several years, Phil had been worrying over what to do with WINX, a small radio station my father had bought in 1944, hoping to create some profits to ease the effects of the Post's accumulated losses. Dad had actually wanted to get a network station at the time, but when he couldn't, he bought this tiny, independent 250-watt station, which could be heard within a radius of about 2 blocks on a windy day. It did make a little money, but my father quickly learned that what it made came from broadcasting the daily number for gamblers and racketeers. He had the station management substitute classical music for the race results, and the bottom fell out of the profits. When Stanton called Phil in Nassau to ask if he'd be interested in purchasing a majority share of CBS Radio in Washington, with the understanding that they would make an effort to acquire a television license later, Phil replied facetiously, "Not much, but I'll take the next plane up." He was ecstatic. We cut short our trip so that he could hurry north to begin negotiations, and for several weeks he shuttled back and forth to New York. Years later, Frank told me that he had earlier held conversations with Sam Kaufman at the Evening Star about their possible affiliation with CBS. Kaufman had expressed great interest in the opportunity, and the deal was nearing completion when, at the end of a lengthy talk in his office, Kaufman, an eminent leader of Washington's WASP establishment, said, "By the way, Mr. Stanton, how much of CBS is Jewish-owned?" Frank immediately replied, "All of it, Mr. Kaufman," put on his hat, and left the room. His call to Phil came soon after this. The negotiations between CBS, whose chairman was Bill Paley, and the Post were easy and quick, in large part because they were conducted by Frank and Phil themselves. Phil was a very able negotiator. He had the figures in his head and knew how to operate in this kind of situation, no doubt greatly helped not only by his law school training, but by what he told me was the most valuable course he took at the school, accounting. A month after the whole thing began, the baby was due, and I was resting. Phil woke me and asked me to talk to Frank's wife, Ruth, on our back porch while he completed the negotiations in the library with Frank. I had never met Ruth Stanton before, but we chatted amicably for a couple of hours. Frank and Phil concluded the deal, which was announced with great fanfare on May 17, 1948. The Post and CBS would co-own the 50,000-watt Washington station WTOP, with 55% owned by the Post and 45% owned by CBS. Privately, Phil was delirious with excitement. It was the real moment of the Post's entry into a new business world and into the electronic world. On the evening of my talk with Ruth Stanton on our back porch, we went to a cocktail party in honor of Margaret Truman. There was the usual amount of standing around, and I began to feel contractions starting and told Phil I thought the baby might be coming. When he asked how I knew, I realized that this was the first time he was really involved with a baby's birth. It was his third child, and he still didn't know what happened. I didn't want to leave for Johns Hopkins and find out I was mistaken, but when the contractions grew stronger, we set out, having reserved a hotel room in Baltimore in case this was false labor. About halfway there, I suggested that the hospital was indicated. Phil sped up, and we made it with only 20 minutes to spare before things got serious. I had asked my doctor about natural childbirth, which had begun to be in vogue, and when he insisted that it wasn't for me, I took this as a challenge. Even though I hadn't had any of the training involved, I made a resolve to have this baby without anesthesia if I could, but not to say anything in case I couldn't. There are certain experiences, childbirth is one, moving is another, that nature and time definitely draw a curtain on, so you forget in between times how painful they are. In this case, after 4 hours I was about ready to give up when the doctor said, "If you can stand one more contraction, you can have the baby." Although I was convinced I was exploding, I did, and our second son was born. It was indeed traumatic, and I kept reliving the sensations for some weeks after, but I was pleased at having done it this way. I was even more pleased with the reality of William Graham, whom we gave the middle name Welsh after Phil's grandmother, who regarded Phil, or at least so he claimed, as her favorite grandchild. The baby and I returned home 6 days later to a haven on our third floor, where we were quarantined against chickenpox, which Lally had caught. Phil surprised me by having installed our first television set. People were just starting to buy them, and there was a good deal of intellectual snobbery in Georgetown about having one at all. Our first evening home, the Restons came over, and we all watched a baseball game until I wilted into bed next door with the baby. By mid-1948, the Post was still a rocky, if lively, paper, whose 800 employees were a proud, generally hard-working lot. In the 15 years since my father's purchase, circulation had risen from 50,000 to 180,000 daily, while advertising had gone from 4 million lines to 23 million. The Post had been awarded numerous prizes, including 5 major awards for reporting, 3 for editorials, 1 for cartooning, and 3 for public service. Around this time, my father decided to pass the paper on to Phil and me. At the same time, he wanted to ensure that the Post would forever serve the public interest. In effect, what he and Phil did was to set up a kind of trust based on an English model that protected some of the newspapers there. According to a page 1 article in the Post, to ensure its continued independence and a responsible ownership in the event the paper ever had to be sold, my father appointed a self-perpetuating committee of 5 persons who will hold full power of approval or veto over the disposition of voting shares in the Post, subsequent to the control now exercised by Mr. and Mrs. Philip L. Graham. The committee, originally made up of James Conant, president of Harvard University, Millicent McIntosh, dean of Barnard College, Judge Belitha J. Laws, chief justice of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, Colgate Darden, president of the University of Virginia, and Chester Barnard, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, had absolutely no authority over or responsibility for the policies or operation of the paper, but had absolute discretion to approve or disapprove potential owners subsequent to ownership by Phil and me. The press release that announced these moves went through a number of drafts that were edited by both my parents. It still moves me in its honest expression of my father's beliefs about what he had tried to do with the Post over the previous 15 difficult years. To survive, a newspaper must be a commercial success. At the same time, a newspaper has a relation to the public interest which is different from that of other commercial enterprises. This is more than ever apparent in these days when our free institutions are under their severest trial and closest scrutiny. The citizens of a free country have to depend on a free press for the information necessary to the intelligent discharge of their duties of citizenship. That is why the Constitution gives newspapers express protection from government interference. It is also possible for the public interest to be defeated by the way a newspaper is conducted, since the principal restraint upon a newspaper owner is his self-restraint. Phil and I both signed a formal letter to my father that read, "You have discussed with us your ideas concerning the Washington Post, and we are, of course, familiar with the provisions of the amendment of the Certificate of Incorporation of the Washington Post Company that is to be made in order to ensure, as far as possible, that those ideas shall be perpetuated. We are very gratified that you have decided that it will be consistent with your hopes for the future of the Post for us to be the owners of the voting shares of the company, and that you have therefore agreed to sell your holdings of Class A stock to us." On his birthday that year, just before this announcement, Phil received $75,000 as a gift from my parents. Though my mother sent it with a note saying she was giving it to him as a birthday and wedding anniversary present, "with all my affection," It was really to help him buy his share of the stock in the Post. Phil and I each already had 175 shares of Class A common stock of the company, which had been given to us by my mother in November 1947. We bought the other shares from my father at $48 per share. In effect, 3,325 shares were transferred to Phil and 1,325 shares were transferred to me, giving us a total of 5,000 voting shares. Phil received the larger share of the stock because, as Dad explained to me, no man should be in the position of working for his wife. Curiously, I not only concurred, but was in complete accord with this idea. 2 years later, the transition to us was completed with the gift of the rest of the shares to the Eugene and Agnes Meyer Foundation, which had been set up in 1944. The foundation had been a very small one, made politically and economically much larger by the acquisition of the B shares. It was set up very carefully to be independent in its administration and not a tool for the family's use. This was carried out, perhaps overly zealously, to the extent that my father could not get the foundation to do anything even remotely connected to his interests. By now, there is no connection at all between the family and the foundation, but it has been an effective force in the Washington area. In order to make things equitable for my siblings, who would not be gaining ownership of the paper, my parents gave an equal amount of money to them at this time. There were a few tense moments when my father told them about the arrangement, but nothing like the difficulties that were to develop in other newspaper families. My brother had some second thoughts, but decided to stick with his decision to pursue his medical career. Bill was asked to invest when we bought the Times Herald, and at other times, and though his advisors at Morgan Guarantee constantly warned him not to buy any more stock when we went public, he obstinately kept adding to his position. When he died of a combined stroke and lung cancer in 1982, with the stock still in the 30s, he left some very wealthy children and a large foundation. Flo, who was already estranged from the family, was with some difficulty reassured by my father that she and her children were being fairly dealt with. Biss and Ruth, who had every right to feel unevenly treated, have remained generous, loyal, loving, and supportive in every way. They were left secure but not affluent compared with my brother and myself. They were never given the opportunity to buy Post stock, largely because it was worth very little in the beginning and was regarded as risky. Later, Morgan kept them out, even after one sister wanted to buy stock as a sign of support of the paper during Watergate. With true conservator instincts, the bank wouldn't sell appreciated and they thought valuable standard stock, such as IBM. This was even after Warren Buffett had taken a big position in the Post Company. They were still denigrating our stock and me to my brother's heirs after he died. On my part, in order to help Phil pay back the debt he incurred in borrowing to buy the stock, even with my mother's gift, I volunteered to pay for all our living expenses, houses, cars, schools, entertainment, and did so. Everything except Phil's personal expenses was carried by me from the modest trust started for each of the Meyer children by my father the day we were born. This arrangement was never an issue. It didn't bother either one of us. I never thought about it, and we never talked about it. Only 15 years later, when things were very bad, did I look at the situation ruefully. I recall my brother-in-law Bill Graham gently telling me it had been wrong from the start. 2 days after the sale of the Post to us was announced, when much of the family, including Phil and me, was at Mount Kisco, we received word that Sissy Patterson had died suddenly of a heart attack at the age of 63. It seemed impossible that this colorful, dynamic, strong, but sad and lonely person was gone. She had been in increasingly poor health, and there were plenty of tales around town of drugs and other habits that increased the danger to her life. But still, she was a Washington institution and seemed destined to be here always. Most important for Phil and me as the new owners of the Post was what would happen to our competition, the ever-present, widely read Washington Times Herald, which Sissy had owned, edited, and published. Speculation began right away. Rumors were rampant. Sissy's more liberal and estranged daughter, Felicia, would inherit and revamp the paper, for example. But Sissy left the paper to 7 of the Times Herald's executives, the principal ones of whom were the general manager, William Shelton, and editorial page editor Frank Waldrop, the operative figure, the closest to Sissy. When Phil heard of Sissy's death, he left Mount Kisco almost immediately to start talks with the Seven Heirs about their intentions. Because of estate tax considerations, the inheritors felt they had only a year in which to decide whether to keep the paper and continue to operate it, or to sell it. We all knew there were too many papers in Washington, and we also knew that only one of the morning papers was likely to survive. It was with this knowledge that Phil began to cultivate his relationships with Shelton and Waldrop. Their conversations continued throughout the year. In any case, we, at 33 and 31, were now the owners of the Post. The paper was then incorporated. My father would no longer pay its losses, which increased Phil's already heavy obligation to make the paper viable. It was another of those crucial moments, another big step in the evolution of our lives. Overnight, we became adults with a huge but exciting responsibility. Chapter 12. Even recognizing how far the paper had come from the wreck my father bought in 1933, what we owned in 1948 still looked pretty fragile. As Phil said, we were sitting in a leaky boat. The paper had practically no assets and had begun to repeat a familiar pre-war habit of losing money. Our hold on the Post and its future was precarious. The Post's dilapidated, roach-ridden building was a fixture on E Street in downtown Washington. One Post reporter described the building as faithful as man-o'-war, but ancient-feeling as Caesar's bones. The front steps opened into a dark, shabby, small vestibule, large enough for the bottom of a long flight of wooden stairs and the creaky, rickety elevator that people wisely avoided. The city room, located on the second floor, was a small town of constant activity. Clouds of smoke hung low over men still in their hats, hunched over typewriters at their desks. Russ Wiggins, who had been in full charge of the news department since he had come in 1947, had done, as Phil said, a most amazing job of developing our news coverage and news writing, taking the paper to a much higher level, astounding, really, since he was on a rigidly tight budget. Together, Phil and Russ created a national staff that was still thin, but beginning to be professional, in great part because Russ's standards of professionalism were high. Russ was once described by Phil as someone who does not lose his Pollyanna-ish enthusiasm easily. Early on, he was involved in a flap with Molly Thayer, a reporter who often used Washington's social gatherings to pick up important news bits. Russ's memo to Phil about her reaction to his changing her copy is typical of his attention to detail and concern for the facts. Molly's suggestion that her copy be left strictly alone is the most colossal impertinence I ever heard. It takes an hour a day to check the spelling and addresses of persons named in her column and to check up to find out if the persons named are dead or alive. She has resurrected more people than Jesus Christ. It was in 1948 that Ben Bradley came to the Post for the first time, and largely by chance. He had returned from the war and started a newspaper in New Hampshire, which did pretty well, but in the end, as with many such ventures, it folded, leaving Ben without a job. He had two reference letters introducing him to editors at major papers, one to the Baltimore Sun and one to the Post. When his train arrived at the Baltimore station, the weather was gray and depressing, and so was the station. Ben took one look through the train's window, said the hell with this, and didn't get out. The train rolled on to Washington, where he arrived at the Post and was eventually sent to Russ Wiggins. Before Ben was hired, Phil had to approve, since he oversaw every empty job slot in order to assess whether we should fill it at all, and if so, ensure that it was filled with the best. Ben was hired and came on board at $80 a week. Only 3 years later, Ben went to Phil and said he'd like to be a Nieman Fellow, which meant going to Harvard for a year under a special program for journalists. To which Phil retorted, "Why, you've already been to Harvard." Ben quit and took a job as information officer in the United States Embassy in Paris, but it was too stultifying for him, and soon he went to Newsweek's Paris Bureau. In many ways, Phil was at his very best as a publisher in these years. He sparked ideas, praised and persuaded, criticized and cajoled. As he went about his more than full-time chores of administration and policy-making, he worried constantly about the difficulties that confronted him as owner and publisher. He was acutely aware of the dilemma that arose from the fact that a newspaper must be a successful commercial enterprise in order to survive. Yet the publisher must realize that he has obligations which transcend any commercial interest. He believed that, despite the difficulties involved, it is best for the publisher to have an ownership part in a paper and not merely represent absentee ownership as a hired man, now almost completely a thing of the past. Phil was always trying to stimulate the press in general, and the Post in particular, to better performance. He insisted that newspapers should not brush off our defects by blithely saying that people can cancel their subscriptions if they disagree, since in many cities there is no choice. He worried continually about basic news reporting and how to do a better job of bringing news to readers. In a speech he gave at the University of Michigan in December of 1948, he said, "The necessary haste with which we operate in the production of a daily newspaper at times leads us, despite our best care, into unavoidable errors. Critics often read into these errors entirely non-existent malice, magnifying them as further evidence of our sins. Responsible newspapers stand ready to correct any errors as zealously as they seek to avoid committing them." On the advertising front, he was constantly writing advertisers like General Motors and Procter & Gamble about campaigns that broke in the Star or Times Herald, explaining why they should have been in the Post. "We are especially equipped to sell ivory for you. Witness our first place in local grocery lineage in the U.S., only morning paper in a metropolitan city to have leadership." Recognizing the difficulties in trying to change old habits, but knowing the inherent cost-effectiveness of automation, Phil began the conversion of the Post's accounting department to machine operation, installing IBM machines as early as 1946. And in an important move on the personnel front, the Post became a pioneer in the city on initiating a policy of hiring reporters on the basis of merit alone. Phil often involved the Post in righting wrongs as he saw them. Apparently, he had always had in mind the idea of a congressional investigation into organized crime. In May of 1949, he met with Senator Estes Kefauver, whom he thought of as a decent man with a lot of guts, to broach the idea of Kefauver's taking on the chairmanship of a special crime committee to investigate the connection between organized crime and politicians around the country. After a second meeting, Kefauver declined the idea as lacking public interest, to which Phil exclaimed, "Jesus, Estes, don't you want to be vice president?" But after Phil ran a few front-page stories about crime, the senator expressed a fervent interest in getting started on the hearings that were to rocket him to fame and national recognition. When Kefauver eventually closed down the hearings, Phil said to him that he understood he was going to write an article for Look or Life, and he would appreciate it if Kefauver gave the Post credit for helping get the investigation started. To which Kefauver replied, "Well, Phil, old man, I'd be glad to do that. But tell me, just what did the Washington Post have to do with starting the investigation?" Another wrong that Phil was willing to use the Post to right was segregation in Washington. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, particularly prior to the Supreme Court's decision in the Brown v. Board of Education case, Washington was a highly segregated city. Phil's entire childhood and adolescence had been spent, as he conceded, in the Southern tradition of white supremacy, and he was fully aware of the difficulties in bringing about the necessary change. In his first brief tenure at the Post, Ben Bradley was deeply distressed by the side of Phil that used the paper to achieve his political purposes, however worthy. In 1949, riots were taking place as members of the leftist Progressive Party, which had fielded Henry Wallace as a candidate the year before, led black children to swim in Washington's previously all-white public swimming pools. The violence grew steadily into pitched battles. In one case, there were 200 whites arrayed against an equal number of blacks, with park police on horses in the middle. Ben, with another reporter, was on the site for 36 straight hours. Emotions ran high, including those of the reporters, who had witnessed the use of clubs with nails embedded in them and had seen several people sent off to hospitals, as well as one woman trampled by a horse. The reporters returned to the Post to write the story, expecting, of course, that it would be on the front page. It didn't even make the front page of the local news section. Instead, it appeared buried in the paper on page B7. As Ben later remembered, the whole 36-hour adventure was called an incident, and the word race was never mentioned. In the process of blowing his stack as only he could do, Ben felt a tap on his shoulder and turned around to find Phil, tuxedo-bedecked, who said, "Okay, Buster, come with me," and led the way to his office. Around the table in Phil's office sat Secretary of the Interior Julius Cap Krug, Undersecretary Oscar Chapman, President Truman's Special Advisor Clark Clifford, and two or three others.
"Tell them what you just told me,"
Phil ordered Ben, after which he asked Ben to leave. Phil then cut a deal. The story would run on the front page of the Post unless the people with the power to do something about it integrated the pools. They agreed, shutting down the pools in the middle of that hot summer, but promising to reopen the following summer on an integrated basis, which they did. This was a typical example of the way Phil used power, in this case the papers, to accomplish something good. It worked, but at the same time it hurt the paper. It isn't, and probably wasn't even then, the way to run a newspaper. To keep a story out of the paper to achieve a purpose, even a fine one, is neither appropriate nor in the spirit of my father's definition of the duty of a newspaper, to try to tell the truth, to find it out and tell it, to have a competent editorial department to interpret that truth. From the time of Sissy Patterson's sudden death in 1948 until the following summer, the most important activity in which Phil was involved was his unrelenting attempt to buy the Times-Herald. We believed that our lives, or rather the company's life and the life of the Post, depended on our acquiring it. Others we knew who were interested included William Randolph Hearst, Jr., the ever-eager Samuel Newhouse, and the Scripps Howard Organization, which owned another one of our competitors, the Washington Daily News. Phil felt he had a real chance because Sissy Patterson's cousin, Colonel Robert McCormick, the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, showed no interest in the Times-Herald at the time, and it was worth more to us than to any of the others. From the beginning, Bill Shelton, the Times-Herald's general manager, agreed that we were the ones who ought to get it. But he also felt that Frank Waldrop, who had been closest to Sissy and was most loyal to her memory, was likely to be a fly in the ointment. How big a fly, I never knew, until recently. Waldrop had not only worked for Sissy Patterson, but respected her, indeed loved her. He felt he owed her everything, and he admired her guts, the fact that she was really trying all the time, trying right up to the day she died. Shelton and Phil, sometimes with Waldrop, held regular negotiations until summer, when the year of decision would be up. When the heirs decided to sell, Phil and my father made a secret written proposal to the seven executives, offering $4.5 million. In addition, my father put up another $1.05 million for the Chicago Tribune stock that was in Sissy's estate, with the understanding that he would help the executors liquidate it, something Shelton and Waldrop had asked for, taking whatever Colonel McCormick didn't want. That summer, we rented a house in Narragansett, Rhode Island. Phil commuted on the weekends, always tired and nervous over the negotiations on top of all his other work. I often would remove the children from the small house so he could sleep. I remember taking them outside on one cold, rainy Saturday for what I described to them hopefully as a picnic breakfast, just to make sure we wouldn't wake him. On the weekend before the negotiations were to become final, just before Phil was to leave for Washington, he and I sat on the beach alone, talking and dreaming. I vividly recall his saying, "I know getting the Times-Herald would be too good to be true. It's too much to hope for. But just let's shut our eyes for a moment and pretend we have it. The first thing I'd like to see is Sam Kaufman's face when he hears the news." After we'd indulged ourselves this way for a while, he realistically and soberly said.
If we don't get it, I'll die for a week. Then I'll try to think of doing it another way.
We were cautious, but we couldn't help hoping that this would be the end of the long, hard struggle. Phil called me early the next morning with the news that Colonel McCormick had stepped in and bought the paper. He asked me to break up the house there, take the children to Mount Kisco, and come down to be with him. Weeping, I sat at breakfast with the children before I began the move to join him in Washington. What we didn't understand at the time was that we might have got the paper at that point if not for Frank Waldrop's loyalty to Sissy's aims and aspirations. Yes, we were willing to pay the most for the paper, which pleased the other six heirs, but Waldrop believed it would frustrate Sissy's intent. He felt it would have been a betrayal and surrender, a sentence of death for the Times Herald. So he told the other heirs, "Do as you wish, but I'm not going to sign it." Waldrop made sure the colonel heard about my father's willingness to take care of the Tribune stock. Unfortunately, McCormick interpreted this not as something helpful, but as a threat to his total control of the great enterprise, and he stepped in and bought the Times Herald for just what we had offered. Phil and my father tried to raise their offer. Mother, always magnificent in a crisis and wanting to ensure the future of the Post, called from Mount Kisco to say that if the sale hinged on the amount we were offering, then she didn't need to live so elaborately. "Eugene, throw in the house. Nothing else matters." She really meant it. We all had our hearts and souls in this deal. However, the Tribune and Times Herald people actually hid from our lawyers to prevent being presented with our higher bid, and we never really got the chance to up the ante. When I arrived in Washington, I found Phil in a great despond. We both thought the future much dimmer, if not hopeless. Now we were faced with the great, rich, highly professional, and profitable Chicago Tribune Company as our competitor, with the colonel, whose business acumen was widely known and respected, having seemingly unlimited assets to pour into opposing us. More than ever, we thought in terms of a battle for survival, now against Goliath. One night, a week or so after the takeover, I woke up at 2 in the morning to find Phil smoking and finishing a book he had obtained from the library on the lives and careers of newspaper magnates Colonel McCormick and Captain Joe Patterson. Phil said, "You know, they put the company together when they were in their 30s. Now they're in their 60s and I'm in my 30s. I think we can make it another way." With that simple conclusion, Phil got over the terrible blow of being defeated in a deal on which we thought our life depended. And so the struggle for survival continued, absorbing all Phil's energy and attention. The Post continued to grow in quality and influence, and even in some important business measures, like circulation, but lost ground on others, like advertising. These were lean years, yet we moved steadily forward. Our competition was formidable and fierce. Various members of the families that owned the Star served on the boards of the most important banks and businesses throughout Washington. The paper also appeared to have a heavy hand in running the government of Washington, D.C. John Russell Young, who was chief of the city's three commissioners, was the former White House correspondent for the Star. The offices of the city's Board of Trade were actually located in the Star's building. Judges were appointed only with the approval of the Star. At least on the surface, the Star was all-powerful and omnipresent. Almost everyone in the top management of the Star was a member of one of the three families that owned the paper. With the exception of a few fine professionals, most drew a paycheck and did little real newspaper work. The editor, Ben McKelway, was an outside professional, a nice man, with fine credentials. Members of the family tended to live not in the city, but in Chevy Chase or the Maryland suburbs, where they rode to the hounds. Many were snobbish and waspish. My father actually included as one of his assets the 27 members of the owning families on the Star. The Times Herald also continued to be a force in Washington. Bill Shelton and Frank Waldrop remained on the paper, but shortly after he bought it, Colonel McCormick appointed his niece, Ruth Elizabeth Basie McCormick Miller, as publisher. The colonel had remarked that he intended the paper to be an outpost of American principles, and called Basie and her husband, Maxwell Peter Miller, Jr., missionaries to print these principles. He said that, after trying for so many years to bring Washington to the United States, he was now sending the United States to Washington. The fourth paper in Washington, the Daily News, was still perking along in its own niche, which was largely lunch counter and street sales. What we tried to do at the Post was to reach the average reader, in contrast to the Star, which was geared to the city's power structure and a middle and upper income readership, and to the Times-Herald, which appealed to blue-collar, downscale, and upper-crust lovers of scandal and gossip. Phil obviously kept an eye out for the competition, but he felt, as did my father, that improving our own paper was the surest way to improve our chances of survival. As Russ Wiggins remembered, we didn't really get into slugging matches in the old partisan newspaper tradition. We covered the news and competition with them, but we didn't get into vituperative disputes. And this attitude of honest competition played an important role then and later. On the business side, Phil succeeded in hiring a first-class circulation manager, Harry Gladstein, from Hearst's Los Angeles Examiner. This position had been a revolving door of incompetence and amateurism, so Gladstein's arrival late in 1949 helped solve a problem that had been a sore spot from the beginning. But Phil's most important business recruit was John Sweeterman, who came as business manager and eventually became publisher, the only non-Meyer Graham family publisher of the Post to date. He had been general manager of the Dayton Journal-Herald, and when that paper was sold to Cox Newspapers, he temporarily published a group of shopping newspapers and was president of a publishing company that printed circulars. Phil courted John assiduously for a few months, but looking at a paper that was losing money and was still third out of four papers in Washington, John declined the offer, holding out for a higher salary and some stock participation. Phil asked me to listen in on one of the crucial phone conversations in which John spelled out his terms. Phil was so anxious to get him that he offered John the same salary that he himself was making at that time, $30,000. When John said he simply couldn't come for $30,000, Phil raised his own salary to $35,000 and offered John the same. One of John's first visits to us was at home, where I was in our yard with the children, all of us barefoot in the summer heat. My being barefoot made a deep impression on John, which he often recalled as culture shock. He finally accepted Phil's offer, arriving at the Post in mid-1950, and almost immediately Phil and others felt they were in good, sure hands. And so the case proved. There was a great deal of mutual respect between Phil and my father on the one hand and John on the other. John later said, "I was so impressed with your father, with his wisdom, his manner, his strong personality, and the same with Phil. I put my future in their hands, really." For his part, Phil was certain we had found ourselves a prize package, and felt, as he once said, "Aren't I a lucky son of a bitch? This guy could run General Motors." After a short while, Phil gave John great autonomy, in effect saying, "You run the business side of the paper, and I'll back you up." John immediately set to work redesigning parts of the paper and cleaning up the organization. He brought in a great production manager, Harry Ibers, and a fine classified advertising manager, Jim Daly. This was the nucleus of the team, together with Don Bernard and Harry Gladstein, that brought us such success later. John was very strong and dominating. At times, he was at loggerheads with various editors or executives on the news side, particularly Russ Wiggins, who wanted to do some things that required money, which John basically didn't like to spend. He was famous for focusing on cost-cutting measures, which many others looked on as mere penny-pinching. But in the end, it was John's single-minded pursuit of cost-cutting and revenue-generating moves that helped turn the situation around. Indeed, under John's direction, and because of his introduction of more professional business management, we started to make very real gains in circulation and in advertising. He also focused on building the Sunday paper. One of the results of losing the Times-Herald in 1949 was the immediate plunge my father and Phil took with the decision to build a new plant. When Dad bought the Post, someone asked him if he was going to build a new building, a natural question, given the look of the Post's home. His response, however, was, "No, I'm going to try to build a newspaper first." Having done that, he was ready to move on to provide a better operating environment for the growing paper. At the time, the Post's 800 employees had spilled out of the 56-year-old E Street home into three other buildings. The paper was handicapped by the inadequacies of both its building and its equipment, and there was no room to expand production capacity. Land had been acquired in another section of the city, on L Street, between 15th and 16th, with additional space behind. The new building, which Phil considered the most important step affecting the paper since 1933, as well as a testimonial to our faith in its future, was made possible financially by loans from my parents for the $6 million cost of the project. We are still there, with expansions, more than 45 years later. When the new building was halfway up, Phil called in my mother and me to more or less sign off on the interior design. Consulting us on decor was not a great idea, since neither of us had a very good eye or track record in this area. Even so, I had definite opinions about what I saw, and said I thought it was hideous. Phil, expecting quick approval, was understandably irritated. He said, "All right, if you don't like it, then do something about it. Find someone to do the interiors." I got the name of an interior designer, Mary Barnes, who made a great impact, rectifying some of the worst mistakes and putting a presentable look on the building. Because many of the colors she chose were muted, people on the Post referred to her as the Gray Lady. Groundbreaking took place late in 1949, and the first full paper was printed at the new L Street site in November 1950. There was a very alcoholic, emotional party as everyone finally left the old E Street building behind. The party, more of a wake, actually, was, as someone put it, to mourn the death of a building which, with all its inconvenient horrors, was still much loved. In fact, many long-time employees were less than enthusiastic about moving from the dingy but bustling E Street plant into the spick-and-span newness of the quiet L Street building. The new building doubled our press capacity, while providing modern conveniences like air conditioning, soundproofing, and a clean environment, but it looked cold and impersonal in contrast to the old. One Post old-timer was quoted saying, "It'll be all right once we get to spitting on the floor again." At the same time that Phil was working on plans for the new building and expanding the Post editorially, he was working hard to build the business. For years, my father had simply subsidized the paper's losses out of his pocket, but after the A shares were passed to us, we couldn't do that any longer. Luckily for us, the losses had greatly declined, and the radio station we owned with CBS was profitable. Phil always thought of radio and television not as rivals of newspapers, but rather as another form of journalism, and very early he recognized their potential for bringing profits to offset any losses the paper might incur. In 1950, again with CBS as a partner, Phil took the company into the television field by buying a station in Washington, WOIC, whose call letters were later changed to WTOP. Since there was $800,000 cash in WTOP, we had to come up with only $330,000, or 55% of the remaining amount of the $1.4 million purchase price, of which CBS paid the other 45%. My parents loaned us the money for our share of this purchase. Phil wrote to his father at the time, "I think our timing was just about perfect, for it looks as though television here will move out of the red ink this fall. We were anxious to get in because it is going to have great effect on all other media, and especially on radio." Since 1948, when he had drawn us into radio, Frank Stanton had become a close personal friend as well as a business associate. Late in 1952, Frank told Phil that the three owners who had started the only television station in Jacksonville, Florida, WMBR, wanted to sell. About a month before the election in 1952, Phil set the wheels in motion that led to his purchase of the station. 10 days after the election, we left on vacation, stopping first in Jacksonville, where he completed the deal and met Glenn Marshall, one of the original owners, who was staying on to manage the station. Glenn remembered that when WMBR went on the air originally in 1950, there wasn't a television set in the whole of Jacksonville, and the station owners would call dealers daily to see if any sets had been sold that day. The price Phil had agreed to, $2.47 million, was the highest ever paid for a television station at that time, I believe. This was the first time Phil was out ahead of my father, who was slightly nervous about the proposed purchase. It took a call from Don Swatland, Dad's friend and a lawyer at Cravath, the corporate law firm in New York, to reassure him that it was a good idea. Actually, it turned out to be a great idea. Phil always referred to WJXT, WMBR's call letters were changed in 1958, as his rabbit's foot. The station built up enormous strength while it was alone in the field. In fact, it was the only